I haven't done any polls on the subject, and I think that there are many incidents of that kind which would suggest that there is a certain suspicion of where corporate America has been going. But what you will see is actually a movement in the other direction. There is a great nervousness in New York City about the fact that the regulatory environment in New York City of financial activities and the stock exchange and all the rest of it has become too strict. And in particular, Eliot Spitzer and so on has been doing too good a job. So the big fear in New York City is that financial services are going to move to London, where the regulatory regime is easier, and is also going to move maybe to Asia, in particular to Shanghai and Hong Kong. And one of the consequences of that was a report that just came out which suggested that the best thing they can do in order to retain financial services in New York City is to deregulate even more. In other words, all of the regulatory things that were put into place after Enron are going to be dismantled because of the competitive need. Now, this is the kind of thing you read on the business pages, and I'm not sure people will quite see it, but what was interesting to me was that somebody like Eliot Spitzer, who had been a very strong campaigner against corporate malfeasance on Wall Street, immediately came out and agreed with this report because he's now governor and he has to back whatever it is that's going to keep New York as a global financial center. So I think there's a certain awareness, but I don't think there's a very deep awareness of the kinds of complexities of doing this. So my feeling here was, well, we learned something from the Enron, at least I hope we did, or I hope a lot of people did, but now it's being absolutely reabsorbed partly by these kinds of mechanisms, which, by the way, explains something to me. Why did Henry Paulson, who could have earned something like $52 million a year at Goldman Sachs, move to be Treasury Secretary? A lot of what his work as Treasury Secretary is about deregulating the economy even more, and deregulating financial services in particular, and of course opening up the China trade and all of that sort of thing. So we're seeing that. And in addition, I get worried by these munificent kinds of gestures that we see from people like Soros and Gates and Buffett and so on, which makes it seem like the corporate guys are good guys. The big issue for me is, well, it's very nice they're giving away their money like this. But on the other hand, the big question for me is, what kind of system has it allowed them to make that kind of money in the first place? And I think that what we're seeing is, much as we saw in the 1970s, a corporate campaign, a collective corporate campaign to try and reestablish the credibility and the goodness of what corporate America is about. And I'm not saying it's inherently bad, I'm just saying there's now a corporate campaign to try to do that, to counter what might be seen as the Enron effect and the fallout from the Enron thing, both technically in terms of the regulatory environment, but also I think in terms of image of what corporations are about. Yes. Yeah, I agree with that very much. One of the big problems I have with a lot of the thinking on the left is that a lot of the thinking on the left in these times says that the solution to our difficulties is a local solution, that you go local. And I just don't think that's feasible. I think that plays into the hands of investment bankers and capitalist class interests and all the rest of it. And there's a whole kind of movement that kind of says, well, if we can go to some sort of communitarian solution, if we can go to some local solution, if we can de-link from the global economy, that the solutions lie in that. So a lot of political thinking on the left is small scale and seeks an answer to the big problem by going small scale. This was actually a problem that emerged in the 1830s and 1840s. I mean, the utopian movements of the 1830s and 1840s were thinking about small communities. And that was the answer. What Hausmann said was, no, that's not the answer at all. I take your plans and I expand them and do it. So I think the left should learn from this and think about having very much larger plans than, but that is not the characteristic mode of thinking within many of the oppositional movements, many of the social movements that exist globally. Though there are, of course, international links which are building. You will see this in the environmental movements. You'll see it in the feminist movements. You'll see it in some of the human rights movements. But there is a dichotomy, if you like, in the oppositional movement between those that have a kind of a global perspective and are seeking and are ready and willing to think about global issues, and those that see the answer simply as being saying, forget it, you can't, it's too big, it's too huge, we can't deal with it, all we can do is go find our corner and reconstruct our corner in the way we wish to reconstruct it. And I understand that that urge, but what I don't think is really there is a kind of sense of how that easily that can be co-opted into the dynamics of a capitalistic system. So I agree with you entirely that the thinking of this in terms of scale and the scale at which the system is working and the scale at which we have to construct responses, that there is a, if you like, a mismatch between the scale at which we're thinking of responses, I say we, you know, in general the left is thinking responses, and the scale at which the capitalist movement is working.
Hello. It seems that there are two big, I mean, it seems that as neoliberalism advances and that is a current that goes towards this all sort of financial plan and instability and all these things you talked about. And at the same time, there's that focus of resistance, right? As you were talking in Latin America and other places. And so the neoliberalism as being more and more applied feeds off into that resistance. And so how do you foresee the possible escalation or not or those two forces kind of opposing each other?
Well, I don't have a crystal ball. If I did, I'd use it. I don't know the answer to that. I mean, the dynamics of for example, I'm very surprised there's not been more resistance in this country. I mean, if you look at things like what's been happening to pensions and people's pension rights, I mean, people are being dispossessed. They're losing. You know, and it seems to me there's a sort of connection in my mind between the fact that there's this incredible concentrations of wealth going on. And, you know, I mean, okay, head of Goldman Sachs got $52 million last year. Ask yourself the question, where did that $52 million come from? Where did it come from? What production underlay it? What activity? And then you look at something and you say, well, actually, one of the things that's happened over the last 3 years, just to give an example, is that actually United Airlines declared bankruptcy and then reneged on all its pension obligations. And then the federal government picked up that because it's got an insurance scheme, but only at about half rate. So actually, all United Airlines employees have lost about half or two-thirds of their pension rights in the last 5 years. Now, in my calculus, I think, well, maybe that's partly where the head of Goldman Sachs got his $52 million from. And if people would think of that as connected, people would say, hey, I want some of my money back. And actually, there's some very scary things going on because actually where Goldman Sachs is getting its money from are from some new markets, which didn't exist in 1990. I mean, this is the sort of game that gets played. In 1990, they came up with some new markets, sort of currency rate derivatives and credit swaps and so on, completely new markets. And they started to trade in those markets. And the volume of trade in those markets right now comes to $232 trillion, was the figure I saw. Now, if you add up the gross domestic product of the United States, Canada, Europe, Japan, and China, you get $32 trillion. So you have $232 trillion worth working around in these markets against $32 trillion of real output. You kind of say, what on earth is going on here? This is a fictitious system. But it's out of that fictitious system that people like Goldman Sachs are actually getting all their money. They're extracting it from that. And then it's real, because then they can go off and buy the McMansions and, you know, buy the Democratic Party and a few other little things like that. So when you look at this, you kind of say, what is going on? And then I was very comforted by the fact that, well, okay, somebody who was writing about this kind of said, well, actually, the real liabilities in these markets is only 10%. And you kind of say, oh, that's very nice. That means it's, you know, $23 trillion. And that's only 2/3 of the gross domestic product of all of those countries. And you kind of go, you see, one of the things that we really have to do is to start to think about the mechanisms by which incomes are being redistributed, wealth and power is being redistributed through the construction of markets of this kind. Who constructed these markets? How do these markets actually work? And let us look, therefore, at the connections. And when I kind of say, if all United Airlines employees suddenly thought that their money was disappearing into the hands of Goldman Sachs, they would probably be pretty annoyed and maybe want to do something about it, instead of which people say, oh, it's terrible, this thing happened. Now, there was a saying back when people would say, only connect. And there is this big question for me, where is all this wealth which is being piled up at the top of the ladder coming from? Who is losing? Goldman Sachs, for example, is active in Mumbai, in the property market in Mumbai. One of the things that's happening in Mumbai, I said, was you're dispossessing, you're throwing out people from the slums. The slums are being cleared to make way for property development. And there's been a lot of legal argument about the right to compensation of people who've lived in slums for many, many years and had a productive life there. And they're being cleared out of there. They're illegal. They have no property rights. They're being cleared out, and so a lot of court cases were brought about, well, they should have property rights because they've been there for a long time. And the Indian Supreme Court recently decided, it is probably a Supreme Court which is about as good as our Supreme Court, it recently decided that, no, you should not compensate slum dwellers who were being thrown off their property because they were illegal. And they actually used the following language. They said, to compensate them would be like rewarding a pickpocket for their actions. And this is the kind of thing that's going on. And hardly surprisingly, there is a good deal of kind of critical social movement in India around these kinds of dispossessions which are going on. Now, I don't know how this is going to work out. I mean, one of the big issues, it seems to me, is the awareness. And here I think academics have a real big problem. We have not gone far enough in cultivating an awareness of these issues and how it works. And a lot of the time, the academic world has become neoliberal. Okay, you're supposed to be an entrepreneur. You're an entrepreneur of ideas, and that's all it's about, you know, and there's jockeying for power and position and all the rest of it. And by the way, who provides all the research money? I mean, I essentially lost my position at Johns Hopkins because I didn't bring in enough research money. And when I suggested, well, that is a bit hard. I mean, I can't imagine me setting up an Institute of Marxist Studies courtesy of General Motors. And the dean looked at me and said, well, no, I think that would be a very good idea. I mean, the biases that now exist in academia around what it is you can study and how you can study it are being set in these kinds of ways. So there are all sorts of as it were, ideological barriers, misunderstandings. There's a tremendous amount of work to be done, it seems to me, in terms of trying to get people to understand what the connections are. Now, here, of course, this is also difficult because I can't actually prove that the money from United Airlines employees ended up in Goldman Sachs' pocket. I can't actually prove that. All I can do is infer that if they made a lot and they lost, there was probably some relationship between what was lost and what was gained. But I can't actually show it. And so people immediately say, well, you can't show it, so why are you saying such ridiculous things? Until you can show it, I'm not going to. But it's interesting about capitalism. They have all kinds of data about things which are largely irrelevant. And the things you really want to know, you can never find unless they really want to know it. And it was fascinating to me. You know, they used to say they couldn't track money. That's impossible, they'd say. Then all of a sudden you find after 9/11, they're tracking every bank transaction through Swift Bank everywhere. They can do it if they want. They just don't want, because we might find out too much. So here, too, I think there's a real set of issues about our awareness, our knowledge of how the system's working. And there's a tremendous amount of work to be done. And a lot of the time it's not being done and not being communicated. So there's an awareness issue of that sort. But also, at the same time, there is always an instability, always a volatility. Even in this country, there are a possibility of very strong political movements. This country is inherently rather volatile. I've lived through moments when this country was really roiled up. Right now, it seems to be pacified by cappuccino. And you know, Starbucks is it. And so, you know, but you never know. I mean, these things are very volatile. And I think what we've seen, for instance, in Latin America is a volatility of political culture and a political movement. And you also see it in many other parts of the world. So I can't predict. I just have no idea. But what I do know is that, yes, there's a lot of discontented people out there. And the problem is putting all those discontents together and finding some way to think about an alternative and also to make the connections to see what the nature of the real problem is.
This sort of dovetails with what you were just saying, so maybe you've addressed it in your own way, but accompanying this transformative shift to neoliberalism in the 1980s, 1970s and 1980s into the 1990s, present was a shift, or at least the ascendancy of a new kind of discourse, which had been present, but I think it seems to me become more solidified, and that's a discourse of this dichotomy between being something as efficient or inefficient or productive versus wasteful. And I think there's, especially for younger generations of students coming up who even as activist students, and certainly for middle classes around the world, there's a certain intuitive understanding that when something can be productive or unproductive, which is very much tied into the broader discourse of what capitalism is about, a sound investment versus an unsound investment. And part of the question is how do we go forward beyond that discourse, which in many ways was made real or acceptable even in the Clinton administration when Gore goes on and he breaks his little box or whatever he did on David Letterman and said, you know, the era of big government is over, right? It's sort of basically accepting this idea that government should be efficient, capital should be efficient. How do we go beyond that discourse to return to, I think, what you're saying of re-envisioning how capitalism could work, or at least how to harness capitalism in a different way? And just a kind of related question is, if we sort of know where the money is, how do you get the money?
Steal it. You know, the question you raise is, there are two steps I would take in relationship to your first question. The first is, it's a myth that the private sector is more efficient than the public sector. If you ever traveled on the French train system, or the Japanese train system, and then you try traveling on Amtrak, you'd see a huge world of difference. There's nothing more inefficient than the way in which healthcare is organized in this country. I mean, Paul Krugman, for example, has been pointing that out endlessly. It is the most inefficient thing you could possibly come about. The amount of overhead in administrative overhead in Britain or Canada with the national health systems is, I don't know what it is, about 5-7%, something like that, and in America it's something like 15-18%. I mean, in other words, this idea that somehow or other public is inefficient by definition and corporate is efficient by definition is entirely false. The evidence does not add up to that at all. There are certainly public systems that are inefficient, but then there are also public systems that are highly efficient. And actually, use the French case. I mean, the French case and the French social service administrative system is highly efficient. Doesn't always work perfectly, but the first step would be to sort of challenge this kind of mythology that somehow or other public is inefficient, private is efficient. It's just not true. And I think one of the scary things in this country, as I mentioned about World War II, was you had a sort of centrally administered economy that was working extremely efficiently. And this is what, really, so this mythology. But the second thing is, even if there is a certain, even conceding if there may be some sort of truth to the fact that government bureaucracies can become highly inefficient over time, then the big question is, well, are there different ways of delivering public service, and if so, how? What kind of structures do you need? I don't know how you feel, but I've been living in the United States now for 30 years, but it's much more bureaucratized now than it's ever been, as far as I can tell. I mean, the number of forms have filled out, and the number of things you have to do, and the complexity of your income tax forms and all that kind of stuff, I mean, it's just astonishing. So there's absolutely no attempt, it seems to me, to deal with, I mean, it seems to me almost a conspiracy to make all aspects of the public sector so inefficient that you will never, ever believe that they could ever be efficient at all. And so there's a lot of that going on. But at the same time, we clearly need to deal with some of the inherent problems of bureaucratized systems and state structures. We clearly need ways to deal with that. And that means, again, being inventive. And this is where some of the new social movements, it seems to me, do have some very specific ways of starting to think this through. And here you do find local structures of delivery of service and so on sometimes are much more accountable and much more easily, they're much less opaque, so that there may be alternative methods of delivery. And from that standpoint, I think some of the ideas that have come up out of social anarchism and so on sometimes make very good sense in terms of how politics should be organized, how democracy should be organized. I mean, beyond what you're talking about, we also have this kind of problem of how to reconstruct democratic government structures. Because right now, I don't think we live in a democracy. I mean, Bush is delivering democracy to Iraq. He ought to maybe start here, because we've got a real serious problem of a democratic deficit in this country in terms of exactly how the political system is working and the efficiency with which that is actually able to represent political opinion within the country. I mean, there are all kinds of biases within there. So there are many issues here. So I think that, but I would really want to go after this mythology that somehow or other efficiency is here and inefficiency is there. I mean, it's just not the case.
I'm sure that you can come down after the event and ask Professor Harvey. But before we finish tonight, I'd like to present you with this plaque commemorating tonight's event.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.
There's also the post there.
Okay. All right, great. Thank you.
Thank you all for coming.